This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Bridget Dowd. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of July 14th, 2025. Though former U.S. Senator Kyrsten Sinema isn't running for public office, she continues to use hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign funds to pay for plane tickets, hotels, and meals. From KJZZ's politics desk, Wayne Schutzke reports.
Under federal law, candidates not seeking re-election can hold on to existing campaign money for a future race or use it to wind down their existing campaign. But they cannot use that money to pay for personal expenses. Sinema, the Democrat-turned-independent who chose not to seek re-election last year, spent over $100,000 between April and June on plane tickets, luxury resorts, and meals, including nearly $600 at a California winery. Sinema did not respond to a request for comment asking how these expenses related to official campaign activities. She already faces a complaint from a watchdog group alleging past expenditures violated federal election law. Wayne Schutzke, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
More than a third of Arizona's roughly 370-mile-long border with Mexico will soon be a military zone. It's the Trump administration's latest so-called national defense area along the border. A similar zone was set up in New Mexico in April. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Elisa Resnick has more about what that means.
Hundreds have been detained on misdemeanor charges for trespassing on military property inside New Mexico's roughly 170-mile-long military zone. At least two migrants have been convicted so far. The Trump administration says Arizona's military zone will run along a 140-mile stretch near Yuma. The Defense Department hasn't provided an exact map of the upcoming area, but says only federal land will be included.
So, yeah, it would begin at the boundary of Oregon Pipe National Monument, its eastern boundary that connects to the Tohono O'odham Reservation, heading west through Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge.
Miles Traphagen is a researcher with the Wildlands Network who's spent years now mapping how rugged public land along the border has been changed by wall construction.
Yeah, this is a George Bush wall.
Traphagen's truck is bouncing along a graded dirt road that snakes along the border through mountainous terrain just east of Nogales, Arizona. It's about 100 miles east of where he estimates the Yuma area military zone will begin. Around us, long green arms of Ocotillo plants stretch towards the sky on the Arizona side. Housing complexes across the border in Nogales, Sonora poke out from behind a metal bollard wall.
This border wall was built in 2008. And this is the one that goes east from Nogales.
This area isn't part of the military zone taking shape near Yuma. But that doesn't mean the military isn't here.
So right on the left, we have a military vehicle, yeah?
Yeah, we do.
Traphagen's truck dips down into a valley as we pass a big metal striker that's perched on a strip of road above us. It's a tank-like military vehicle with eight rubber wheels and no gun mount. A soldier's legs poke out from behind the open door.
So this is the actual militarization of the border that we're observing here.
About 100 members of the Army's 2nd Striker Brigade combat team have been here since March. A military spokesperson says the soldiers are providing Customs and Border Protection with advanced surveillance and logistical support. There's some of thousands of troops deployed for a joint task force created after Trump declared an invasion at the border in January.
So it's like they have to escalate in order to satisfy the expectation that they've created by their rhetoric from very early on. You call it an invasion, well, you treat it like an invasion.
Dan Maurer is an Army veteran and law professor who also served in the Army's legal arm called the JAG Corps.
Whether it's the desert along the border, or whether it's the city streets in LA, or at a detention facility in Florida, the administration is conditioning the public to see this as a normal thing.
Maurer says the Trump administration is trying to sidestep laws against military involvement in domestic policing.
By putting these installations along the border where we didn't have installations before, they've militarized the border to such an extent that that is now like Fort Hood, Texas, or Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Maurer says seeing armored vehicles like strikers near cities alters how the public sees the military. Living in that new reality is something Angelica Macias is still trying to get used to. She runs a migrant shelter in Nogales, Sonora, where she lives. She says even though she has legal documents to enter the U.S., she still gets scared crossing.
¿Qué nos van a preguntar? ¿Qué nos van a decir? ¿Nos van a dejar pasar? ¿No nos van a dejar pasar?
We're afraid of what they're going to ask us and whether they'll let us through, she says. We've seen that others are detained.
Se siente como zona de guerra. Se siente. Y tienes que estar como alerta, así como tus nervios de punta.
I feel like I'm living in a war zone, she says. Miles Trapagan, the researcher, says border militarization has long been a conversation for communities and rights activists.
You know, we've had border walls. We've had concertina wire, 25,000 Border Patrol agents, high-intensity lighting. You know, functionally, it's been militarized.
But, he says, this time is different. Now, vast stretches of the borderlands are under military control. Hundreds of miles of land in three different states. That's already changing things for his research. Recently, he says, he was told he had to remove his wildlife cameras from the military area in New Mexico.
We're seeing the process progress towards more and more land being taken off the table, taken away from the American public.
The Trump administration hasn't said if more military zones are slated for other parts of the Arizona-Mexico border. Alisa Resnick, KJZZ News, reporting from Nogales.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. This coming Sunday officially marks 6 months of President Trump's second term. For asylum seekers in Mexico, it means half a year since the U.S.-Mexico border was shut to them. From the Fronteras desk, KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky brings us the view from Nogales, Sonora.
The mood is festive at Casa de la Misericordia. This hilltop migrant shelter overlooks Nogales, Sonora, and beyond it, the border wall that lies between the families here and the United States. Today is graduation day. The shelter has its own school, and the families have gathered to celebrate their kids finishing another year. But alongside this joy, there's a sense of desperation.
Tenemos que esperar, sí o sí.
We have to wait, says Rosario, whose two children are part of the ceremony today. She's been at the shelter for months, with plans to cross into the United States. She says she's fleeing cartel violence and threats in her home state of Michoacan, which is why we're using only her first name. But when President Trump took office in January, he suspended asylum claims at the border, closing the door for people like Rosario and her children. A federal judge recently overruled that suspension, but the issue is still working its way through the courts.
Respete el derecho. Porque es un derecho que tenemos al asilo político.
We're waiting for a change of politics, for them to respect our right to seek asylum, says Rosario. But she's part of a shrinking community here. Many of the migrants that were staying at Casa de la Misericordia before Trump took office have left, as their dream to enter the United States dies or gets put on hold. Last year, more than 90 kids crowded onto this basketball court for the end-of-the-year ceremony. Today, it's just over 20. Researcher Israel Ibarra studies migration at El Colegio de la Frontera Norte in Nogales, Sonora. He says Trump's policies have virtually stopped the flow of migrants through Mexico up to Nogales. Many of the asylum seekers who were here before the shutoff are now likely integrating into this border community, says Ibarra.
Estas personas quedaron atrapadas.
These people became trapped, Ibarra says. At another Nogales shelter, San Juan Bosco, Director Francisco Loureiro stands in a room of empty bunk beds.
Historicamente, es la primera vez que sucede.
This is the first time this has happened, Loureiro says, of the historically low number of migrants staying at the 43-year-old shelter his parents started. The shelter has the capacity to house up to 400 people a day. Usually, around 100 to 150 migrants come through every day, Loureiro says. But now, they only receive about 10 to 15 migrants daily, including people who have been recently deported from the United States. Back at Casa de la Misericordia, those who remain at the shelter are preparing to celebrate their school year. Shelter director Angelica Macias tells a group of boys not to ruin their clean white shirts as we walk the colorful shelter grounds. On the basketball court, she shows me photos of students as teachers and volunteers put finishing touches on the movie theater-themed decorations.
Mira, esas ya no están, por ejemplo, ya se fueron.
She points out the faces of the children who have left. Their parents, many in debt after leaving their homes to travel to the border, had to leave the shelter to find work and were forced to take them out of school. As the ceremony begins, the remaining two dozen or so students at the shelter school stand for the presentation of the Mexican flag. 15-year-old Valeria marched with the flag during the ceremony. Her family says they're escaping threats and violence in the Mexican state of Guerrero, so we're only using their first names to protect their safety. Over the past 6 months, Valeria has watched her friends leave the shelter.
Sí, tenía una amiga que era de Veracruz.
Friends from all over have left, from Veracruz, from Ecuador, and Mexico City. It's been hard, she says. Her grade has dwindled down to just 4 students. Valeria likes school, especially math. She wants to be a veterinarian when she grows up. Her family was in the process of getting an appointment to seek asylum in the United States when the Trump administration canceled them all.
Yo quiero seguir esperando.
I want to keep waiting, says her mother, Graciela. She holds 5-month-old Valentina, her youngest child, who was born here in the shelter. She still has hope that policy might change and they'll be allowed to apply for asylum in the U.S. But until then, they're in limbo, unable to go back home and unable to reach the land they came here for. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Nogales, Sonora.
And here's a story from me. A new sports bar in the Melrose District in Phoenix has been open for just about 4 months, but it's already become a popular spot for watch parties and fantasy drafts. It sets itself apart from other restaurants of its kind by prioritizing women's sports. It's about 1 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon at Title IX Sports Grill in Phoenix, and the restaurant is bustling. Some are here to enjoy a WNBA game. Today it's the New York Liberty versus the Atlanta Dream. On the other side of the bar, patrons are watching a men's game. Canada is facing off against Guatemala in the CONCACAF Gold Cup.
What you're going to find here is women's sports, all women's sports, and you'll find some male sports as well, but mostly women's sports and anything that supports that.
That's co-owner Audrey Corley, who is busy selling people merch and making sure her customers are happy, but she makes time for a quick interview. The restaurant's name, Title IX, comes from a law that significantly expanded athletic opportunities for women and girls in the U.S. by prohibiting sex discrimination in educational programs, including sports, that receive federal funding. It led to an increase in the number of female athletes participating in organized sports.
You know, I think it's super important to have visibility in women's sports and a place where people can come and support them. It's on the rise right now, but women's sports have always played an active role in my life.
Corley says by creating a space like this, she hopes to foster greater awareness and appreciation for women's athletic achievements.
If you look at most leaders and women leaders and all that, 80% of them have played sports or some kind of team sports. It teaches you and instills the pride and confidence that you need to do this thing called life, basically, you know, to be great at it and to be part of a team.
She says she knows just how powerful that experience can be because she both played and coached basketball at the collegiate level. That's why she wanted her business to be a place where female athletes are respected the way men are in so many other venues.
You know, sometimes there's a certain different sense of, kind of male toxicity in a lot of those sports, but here you're going to find just a cool environment where everybody's welcome, everybody's here to celebrate women in sports and be community.
And that sense of celebration is everywhere you look. The entryway is plastered with medals and trophies donated by women in the valley, and behind the bar you'll find a giant pink neon sign with the words, "Play like a girl."
Our drinks are all themed around famous athletes, former and current athletes.
Drinks like the Taurasi Goat Tail, named for Diana Taurasi, who spent her entire career with the Phoenix Mercury, and the Billie Jean Spritz, named after Billie Jean King, a former world number one tennis player. The real Billie Jean King even follows the bar on Instagram. But Corley's belief in the power of women and her dedication to supporting them doesn't stop at the restaurant door. After her interview, she dashed to the Phoenix Mercury game, where she received the team's Believe in Women Award. It recognizes outstanding women in sports, business, philanthropy, and public service who are making a positive impact in their communities.
Audrey builds a culture of loyalty and teamwork. She works extremely hard, you know, and I think that has led her to where she is now.
That's Cassie Sawyer, who coached Corley when she played basketball for Phoenix College and now comes to eat at Title IX with her wife, Laura Andrin, who says Corley recently handed out water at a No Kings protest in Phoenix.
Which I thought was great, giving back to the community. Huge truck, lots of water, making sure everybody's hydrated.
But for Andrin personally, she says she appreciates that Corley has created a new safe space for the LGBTQ+ community.
I feel comfortable here. I feel like everybody's welcome, regardless of their race or their sexuality or their gender, age. It's just a very comfortable place to come.
And as a former soccer player, she's happy to see women's sports take center stage.
What we've realized, especially with WNBA, is that it's not necessarily that women aren't stronger, women aren't better athletes or worse athletes. It's that they're not putting the marketing dollars into women's sports, and that really has been the difference.
While the popularity and visibility of women's sports has increased over the years, there are still a lot of disparities. The NBA's revenue is 52 times that of the WNBA, and players don't make nearly the same amount of money. The lowest earner in the NBA earns 4.6 times more than the highest earner in the WNBA. That's part of the reason why the people at Title IX say it's so important to have a place where female athletes can feel seen and valued. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News. Phoenix. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And from KJZZ's original production, The Show, Arizona wants to boost water supplies but is cutting funding. Here's co-host Mark Brody.
3 years ago, state lawmakers and then Governor Doug Ducey said they were setting aside $1 billion over 3 years for a water augmentation project. The thinking at that time was that project would be a desalination plant in Mexico's Sea of Cortez. But last year, lawmakers and Governor Katie Hobbs swept more than $300 million from the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, or WIFA. That's the organization that's responsible for seeking out and funding these kinds of projects. And the organization's director says this year's spending plan isn't much better. Chelsea McGuire says WIFA's board is in the process of reviewing 17 submitted proposals that are looking to be qualified to move on to phase two of a three-phase process. She says by this fall, we should know the basic contours of those water importation proposals, and the teams behind them will be asked to do a feasibility analysis. McGuire joins me to talk about the state of WIFA's finances. And Chelsea, let's start with that recently approved state budget. How did your agency do?
Not well. This is the third year in a row that we have seen significant cuts to WIFA's long-term water augmentation fund in the state budget. The most recent iteration of those cuts totaled about $84 million, which leaves us with about a third of the promised $1 billion that was originally dedicated to that long-term augmentation fund.
And when that money was initially promised, the thinking was that it would lead to, most likely, some kind of water desalination project. The talk was maybe a deal with Mexico in the Sea of Cortez or something like that. Is that project still talked about? Is it still even feasible?
So I'll answer that in two parts and kind of go back to the assumption. I think that was an assumption on the part of a lot of folks. I don't think that was actually the assumption on the part of the policymakers who were designing WIFA and our long-term water augmentation fund.
Okay.
Desalination is, of course, a very obvious solution to augmentation. You're going somewhere, the ocean, to use water that we're not currently using. But that doesn't have to be the solution that is funded by the long-term water augmentation fund, and it's highly likely that it may not be. We don't know yet. We're still agnostic as to what that project looks like. And then to your point, in December of 2022, really just months after the legislation became effective, WIFA was approached with a proposal for a desalination plant in the Sea of Cortez. At that point, WIFA's board, they looked at that and they said, that's really interesting. We're really glad to see that there are proposals out there within the industry. We don't have enough information to make a decision right now. And in fact, we don't know what we don't know. So what we need is not a bunch of proposals just coming in. We need a process for handling those proposals, for attracting those proposals.
Did anybody tell you why WIFA was losing the amount of money it was losing?
I wouldn't say that we've received definitive reasons as to why WIFA is losing that amount of money. What I will say is that the guiding narrative or the most common narrative that we've heard is, well, you don't have a project yet.
So you don't need the money.
What are you spending it on? Unfortunately, that's a pretty self-defeating narrative for a couple of reasons. The first is that the money is there to attract the project. If we as a state are a serious partner at the negotiating table with industry, because even $1 billion was not going to be enough, right? Industry is going to have to come alongside and be a partner with WIFA. That money was there symbolic of our commitment to long-term water augmentation. So it was never the amount. It was about the commitment. And so saying, well, we're not going to commit more money to it until you have a project, it's very hard to attract that project and to be a serious partner if the money is not there.
Have you found it so far to be a hindrance in terms of trying to find a new project, not having the money that you need?
I would say yes and no to that. It is a hindrance in that it makes industry kind of look at WIFA and say, well, are you serious about this? And what can you bring to the table? But what I think is important about WIFA, even with the cuts to our budget, even with the uncertainty that we have over sort of the political stability, we still have the ability to go out to industry and say, we're serious about this. We have a mandate, in fact, from our state to do what we are doing. So keep partnering with us. And the process that we have developed, that going back to what our board asked us to do in 2022 and early 2023, has received extremely positive feedback from industry. We just want to make sure that we can underscore and secure that approach with something tangible to bring to the table.
Well, I kind of wonder about that because you mentioned how the money in some ways is symbolic of the state's seriousness in investing with industry and pulling off a project like this. I wonder if in your mind or maybe in the board of WIFA's mind, the fact that the legislature keeps taking back and cutting some of this money, is that in some way maybe symbolic of the way the legislature looks at your mandate and ultimately what you're able to do?
I sincerely hope not. And in private conversations, it's very easy to hear from legislators, to hear from policymakers. Of course, we still believe that augmentation is important. So we absolutely hear we are still serious about this. Unfortunately, actions can speak louder than words. And so we're in a position right now as WIFA, as an entity, of saying we continue to be serious about this. And we will utilize all of the many tools at our disposal to show that we are serious, to prove that Arizona and WIFA is the right partner for industry that's interested in building these kinds of projects, because they are out there and we've proven that. But we continue to be dedicated to that, and I think that's really the message that we want to send.
At this point, if you had to guess, and of course crystal balls are often cloudy, does it seem as though sort of the one big project is still the way that WIFA is looking? Or maybe given the financial realities under which you're operating, is it maybe a series of smaller projects that are maybe even more regional in nature?
I think it could be both. And when I think of a series of smaller projects, I think of it less in terms of regionality and more of a portfolio. It's really time-bound is where I would look at that portfolio. When I think about a portfolio approach, I do think about it in terms of there could be projects that bring water online more quickly, that could be faster, cheaper, potentially easier to bring on online, but are temporary, are not that big volume of water that we need. But those build a bridge, right? And those build a bridge from our current water situation to our future water situation. But there does have to be something big on the other side of that bridge.
It seems like if nothing else, if you had something smaller, that might at least in part alleviate the argument of you guys don't have a project.
That could be true. That could absolutely be true. And as long as, and I think our board has been clear about this, those smaller projects can complement what happens on the other side. Mm-hmm. And they're not draining resources that then make it impossible to do what we need to do on the other side. We're absolutely open to that portfolio kind of approach.
In terms of the money that got cut from your budget this year, in your mind, is it at least going to something that's somewhat close to what your mission is or even just sort of kind of water related?
The short answer is no. There are definitely some water-related tasks or some water-related categories that those cuts were going to. Potentially the most notable is the $1.7 or so million dollars for the Colorado River Litigation Fund through the Department of Water Resources. But honestly, much of those cuts feel a little bit like we couldn't find money in the budget anywhere else, and so we're taking it from WIFA. Things like fire suppression. Not a bad thing, obviously. Definitely something that we need to prioritize as a state. The problem is prioritizing other things at the expense of our long-term water augmentation future and our ability to attract and to finance and to make affordable whatever that project is at the end of the day.
Well, so given all of that, Do you see the ship has sort of sailed on the state having that investment money, that we're serious money in, you know, in WIFA's hands to attract the kind of private enterprise and industry and, you know, other entities that you're going to need? Or, you know, maybe next year they put some amount of money back in WIFA's budget and it's just fine.
Yeah. I don't think the ship has sailed. And I think that because of the conversations that we've had consistently with policy leaders across the state who say, no, we do understand and we do recognize the importance of augmentation. This is just kind of the thing we had to do. That's unfortunate, and I wish the narrative were different, but I don't think the ship has sailed. I think that there are still leaders in the water policy world. I think there are still leaders across the state who will be willing to go to bat for WIFA and to say, this is important and this work that we're doing is good. They're doing it in the right way, and we want to continue to support that.
All right. That is Chelsea McGuire, Director of the Water Infrastructure Finance Authority, or WIFA. Chelsea, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Bridget Dowd. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.